I needed to not skate by for once in my life, and they didn't let me.
At the end of the day, if you know that you don't feel good about the job, you got to be able to leave that behind.
They just kept asking me to come back, and I truly love Milwaukee and Southeast Wisconsin.
It's always great to be at WTMJ.
This is WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome to WTMJ Conversations. I'm your host, Libby Collins.
You know, most people believe only communities in the South were affected by slavery. But in 1854, Milwaukee, Racine, and Ripon were the center of an incident involving a runaway slave. Now, perhaps you've seen the historical marker in Cathedral Square commemorating the events. Joining us is filmmaker Michael Jarre, whose movie Liberty at Stake, The Joshua Glover Story, is currently in production. We're going to tell you all about it. Michael, first of all, thanks so much for being here.
Libby, thank you for having me. This is a treat.
You know, I'm going to be honest with you. Until I met you, I had never heard of Joshua Glover. Yet, as we just said, there's a plaque commemorating him right here in the city. But who was he? And why are you so fascinated with him that you've put this documentary together?
Great question. And you're not alone. So many people that I talk to have never heard of Joshua Glover, or if they had heard of him, they'd know very little about the story. And even when I first discovered it, I thought, oh, that's a cool story. But I did not realize until just a couple years ago the national impact and the history-changing impact that Joshua Glover's story had. So Joshua Glover was a fugitive slave. He escaped from a 300-acre farm in St. Louis, crossed the Mississippi, and found his way up about 400 miles to Racine, Wisconsin.
Do you have any idea how he did that?
We have little bits and pieces. We have very little from his own words. He did indicate that somebody helped him as soon as he got into Illinois, provided him some potatoes to eat. But we don't know much beyond that. We just know from the Underground Railroad history that there often were people and churches and places that kind of helped fugitive slaves along the route. And we expect that's probably what happened.
Yeah, we've heard the term Underground Railroad.
Right.
How did that work?
Yeah, so in this case, we know that there were at least two churches in St. Louis that were involved in smuggling slaves from Missouri across the border. And so what we can speculate is that maybe they had a boat or a place where they could cross safely across the Mississippi at night, maybe get some direction or some provision as soon as they got to the other side. And then there were all sorts of ways that they could be kind of direct, a fugitive slave could be directed from point A to point B, sometimes as simple as there were quilts that had certain markings, and they would be draped over, you know, out to dry, for instance. But it might have some indications on there as to which direction the slave should go. They were obviously, you know, guided by the stars. If it was a clear night, they used the stars to head north.
They would travel at night for the most part.
Right, exactly. And then if somebody helped them along the way, they would probably tell them the next place where they could safely get help as well. Because you think about, you know, escaping from a farm in St. Louis and going somewhere you've never been before. There's no phones, there's no GPS, there's no street signs. You know, you have to figure out how to go hundreds of miles to the north, a place you've never been before. It's just kind of dramatic to think about the courage that it took to do that.
Going back to when he escaped, do you have any history or any sort of documentation of how he actually got away from where he was working and his owner? I hate using that word,
yeah,
but it's what it was.
Yeah, we don't. There's very little history, very little information about Joshua Glover's life. Even when he was here in Milwaukee or in Racine, he was only here for a very short time. Nobody really seemed to capture his history while he was here, and we don't know if he was literate, but we don't have any letters or diaries from his own hand.
How did he arrive in Racine? Obviously, he came through the entire state of Illinois, but why Racine? Why did he stop there?
Racine was an abolitionist hotbed. So the people in Racine were known to be very strong anti-slavery abolitionist. It was a strong community.
Would slaves in the South know that?
You could probably get the impression that was the case, because quite often the fugitive slaves did end up in communities where they were going to be helped. So somewhere along the way, whether it was somebody from the church in St. Louis or someone along the path up to Wisconsin, but somebody clearly told him this town is a safe place to go. Now, he may have been bound for Canada, which is, you know, quite often what slaves were aiming to do. But maybe somebody said, this is a fine community. They'll put you up. And they did. When he arrived in Racine, he was welcomed. He was given a job at a sawmill. He had a shack that he lived in on the sawmill grounds, so he had a place to live. And over the course of a couple of years, he actually generated, he must have been a pretty good woodworker because he actually sold some of his items to the people in Racine.
Do you know where in Racine that sawmill was?
I couldn't tell you exactly what's there today. As part of what we're going to be doing is going down there and actually finding that location and filming it, but I don't know that off the top of my head. It's a little bit north and a little bit north and west of the town of Racine.
Were there a lot of runaway slaves who were in Racine at that time?
Not that we know of. There were a handful for sure. And there was a very famous case of a young girl named Caroline Quarles who had come up to Wisconsin, who had been an escaped slave. And she had gotten into kind of a similar situation where the slave catchers tracked her down. And then the people of Wisconsin made every effort to try to keep her from being returned to slavery. I think it was a small handful.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
It's amazing how seemingly obsessed he was with reclaiming his so-called property. Joshua Glover, he had a $200 reward, and he kept that reward out there for at least 2 years.
Filmmaker Michael Jarre describes Joshua Glover's escape from slavery.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with filmmaker Michael Jarre about the mini documentary he's produced, Liberty at Stake, the Joshua Glover story.
If a slave has taken refuge with you, do not hand him over to their master. Let them live among you wherever they like and in whatever town they choose. Do not oppress them.
Well, let's back up then to Joshua Glover. As you said, he made it through the entire state of Illinois, and there were pockets of Illinois that were not necessarily friendly to runaway slaves.
Exactly, and yeah. There was a reward on his head, so a $200 reward, so it'd be very easy for someone to take that opportunity to turn him in.
And at that time, $200 was
a lot of money.
But he did make it safely to Racine. He was working in a sawmill. Do we know, was he married? Did he have any sort of contact with people who would have known his history?
We don't know if he was ever married up until he ended up in Canada, and he did marry when he was in Canada later in life. Prior to that, we don't have any record of him being married or having children, but we haven't traced his whole history, so I don't know for sure.
How old was he when he got to Racine?
We think in his late 30s. There weren't great records kept on the births of slaves. But from what everything we've read, it indicates that he's probably in his late 30s.
All right. So he managed to stay in Racine under the radar for at least a couple of years.
Right.
Was working, made money.
Right.
Probably had a happy life. Probably mm-hmm. felt, I have freedom. I can live my life the way I want. But somewhere in St. Louis, there was somebody who said, this was my property. It's gone. And I want it back. So how did the individual there track Joshua Glover to Racine?
So Benamy Garland was the name of his slave owner. Benamy had purchased Joshua Glover on New Year's Day, 1850, on the courthouse steps of the St. Louis courthouse at an auction.
For how much?
I don't know that. But he had him for about 2 years. It was May of 1852 when Glover escaped.
What kind of work was he doing for him?
It was a pretty expansive farm. So they did everything from they grew oats and potatoes to they had dairy cows and pigs. So he would have, 300 acres. So a pretty substantive farm and a fairly small group of slaves. So he probably would have worked pretty hard doing just about everything that you would do on a big farm.
How was he able to track him to Racine? How did he know that's where he went?
It's amazing how seemingly obsessed he was with reclaiming his so-called property. He had a $200 reward for anybody who could help him to find Joshua Glover, and he kept that reward out there for at least 2 years until the slave catchers eventually tracked Glover down in Racine.
Who are the slave catchers?
So the slave catchers.
Slave catchers or
that's
trackers?
What they were called. They were called slave catchers, and there would be a bounty on someone's head, and they would go out and try to track that individual down. And because so many fugitive slaves were escaping from so many areas of the South, it probably was a very lucrative business, but that was basically their job. They would get information from other people. If somebody showed up in a new community and they, were black and they didn't have any, indication that they were a free man, the word would spread pretty quickly, and that network would eventually help the slave catchers to track someone down.
In 1854, though, there couldn't have been pictures of Joshua Glover. How did they know who they were looking for?
Yeah, good question. I don't know. So Joshua Glover did change his name. He probably would have been Joshua Garland when he was living with Benamy Garland. But he changed his name to Joshua Glover, and we suspect that that may have been the last name of one of his previous owners. So, you know,
he had been moved from owner to owner prior
to
that?
Yeah, right, right. Again, he had been purchased in his 30s on the courthouse steps in 1850 on New Year's Day. So he had been a slave his entire life, so we don't know much about the 30-some years prior to that, but he clearly had been enslaved somewhere else. We're still digging into that history. But so Garland was determined to find him, and the slave catchers finally tracked him down, got the word back to St. Louis. Benamy Garland comes up to Milwaukee to the courthouse.
He actually came.
He comes up here. He says, I have an affidavit with an attorney. And
what was the affidavit?
Basically just a claim that there's a gentleman here in this state who belongs to me, who is my property. So he presents that at the courthouse here in Milwaukee. He's given a warrant for Joshua Glover's arrest. A posse is assembled. There's a couple of U.S. Marshals involved.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
There was a knock at the door, and Glover was a little suspicious, so he said, don't open it. But his friend unlatched the door, allowing the posse to swoop in.
Filmmaker Michael Jarre talks about the night Joshua Glover was betrayed by a friend.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
And I'm Libby Collins. Our guest today is Michael Jarre. He's a filmmaker behind the mini-documentary Liberty at Stake, The Joshua Glover Story.
In February 1854, a man named Benamy Garland entered the Milwaukee courthouse to reclaim his so-called property. He told the judge that Glover had escaped from his farm and demanded that authorities assist in capturing and returning him to slavery. Under the Federal Fugitive Slave Act of 1850, the judge was obliged to comply. The law required slaves who escaped to free states to be returned to their owners.
Wisconsin at that point wasn't part of the South. It was an abolitionist state. How could he have gotten a warrant for a human being that he claimed was his property in a state where they didn't have slavery?
You have hit the crux of the very argument that took place and why this was such a pivotal case. So Wisconsin had been established in 1848, just 6 years earlier, as a free state. But the Fugitive Slave Act had passed in 1850. And that was part of a larger compromise, basically hoping to calm things down between the North and South, and it actually had the opposite effect. But one aspect of that compromise was the Fugitive Slave Act, which put much stronger teeth in the return of fugitive slaves. Too many of the states in the North—
Even from free states.
Exactly, yeah. So many of the states in the North had been not only helping fugitive slaves in the Underground Railroad and getting them to Canada or what have you, but they actually passed laws that provided due process for anybody who was grabbed by a slave owner and claimed to as a fugitive slave. And so the South said, this is outrageous, this is our property, you're being bad, Northern states. We want all these laws, you know, gotten rid of. And so the Fugitive Slave Act made it so that any state official, even individuals of that state, had to help in the return of a fugitive slave. If you were to in any way aid a fugitive slave, there could be up to $1,000 fine, which would just bankrupt somebody, obviously. You could face jail time. And actually, some of these people did, as we will hear a little later in this story. But
all right. So he was able to get this warrant. And who organized, I guess you'd call it, what, a posse?
It was a posse, yeah. So they had two U.S. Marshals. I'm not sure exactly who took the lead in all of this, and a handful of other people. They went by night down to Racine. They knew, again, that it was an abolitionist community, so they were trying to be secretive, and they didn't want to kind of give the alert because they knew that they might face opposition. So they go at night. They knock on Joshua Glover's door.
How did they know which house it was?
So one thing that I've read and we haven't been able to verify is that actually one of Glover's friends had maybe turned him in, had decided, you know, I want this reward or whatever it may be, but had been the one who had somehow allowed the slave catchers to know specifically where he was living.
Would this have been a free man?
It would have been a free man, a former slave.
So it would have been
If the story is true, the gentleman was a former slave who had also ended up in the Racine area, but for whatever reason decided that he wanted the money. There's also a little bit of a potential that Joshua Glover may have had a similar love interest as this gentleman. And so maybe it was over something along those lines, as simple as that. But again, a lot of this is not verified.
Well, that adds a whole other crux to the story, doesn't it?
There's a whole lot of complexity, a lot of drama here. So hard to know. Not all of this is verified, but just through the writings over the course of time, there are indications that he may have been turned in by a fellow fugitive slave, and there may have been a love interest that was involved as well.
So when the posse, for lack of a better word, got to his home, was he alone?
He was with two other friends, including this one that supposedly turned him in.
So this is a real Judas moment.
It is. This is a et tu, Brute kind of moment, yeah, where he may have been sold out. So there was a knock at the door, and Glover was a little suspicious. So he said, don't open it. But his friend, quote, friend, unlatched the door, allowing the posse to swoop in.
And they apprehended him, and they knew that was the individual.
They did. So they came in because Benjamin Garland, the former owner, was with the posse, was part of that posse. So
he
would recognize him immediately. And they swooped in. And of course, anybody, you know, if some, a bunch of people, you know, armed people crash into your house, you're going to like defend yourself. You're going to push back. Joshua Glover did exactly that. As a result, he was struck both by both of the U.S. Marshals and was knocked to the floor, bleeding profusely from a head wound. They then took him out to a waiting wagon that they had rented, threw him in the floor of the wagon on a freezing cold March night, and then headed up to Milwaukee to take him back to the jail there. And he was bound for a lifetime of slavery. He was headed home.
Is there any documentation to whom the reward was given?
Not that I've been able to find. It's a great question. I've wondered that, too. If the story about his friend was true, they may have given him a bottle of liquor and something else. It may have been as simple as that. But again, it's unverified, so I wish I knew more about that. But
so Joshua was brought back to Milwaukee, and where did he end up?
So he's thrown in the jail in the courthouse. And if you know Milwaukee at all, the Cathedral Square used to be the courthouse square. The courthouse stood in that square, and so he was taken there, thrown into a cell, bleeding from his head wound, and sitting there contemplating the fact that he was going to go back to a lifetime of bondage and maybe pretty significant punishment as well. But the word got out.
What was the punishment for being a runaway slave at the time?
There's a whole range of things that could have been done to a slave. Obviously, he could have received a whipping or a beating. He could, which would probably be the best case scenario, as horrible as it is to consider that. But they sometimes would amputate parts of your body. They had these big cast iron collars that they would put on your neck with large spikes that would stick out. So it would be very hard for you to, you know, move, much less walk through like woods or do anything else to try to escape again. And they could even go as far as killing somebody, you know, just to make an example out of them.
Mm.
So, you know, the risks were great, which just, again, shows you the courage that it took and the human desire for liberty that was involved in these fugitive slaves' actions.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
They went over to the cathedral, which was being built at the time, and they grabbed a wooden beam from the construction site. They took it over to the courthouse, and they used it to batter down the courthouse door.
Michael Jarr talks about 5,000 people in the city of Milwaukee who unite to set Joshua Glover free.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm your host, Libby Collins. Let's return to our conversation with Michael Jarr, who's produced a mini-documentary, Liberty at Stake, The Joshua Glover Story.
There was anti-slavery fervor amongst Wisconsinites. One of the leaders of the abolitionist cause in Wisconsin was a man named Sherman Booth, who ran a newspaper out of Milwaukee, an abolitionist newspaper. And he's the one who really rallied the crowd once he found out that Joshua Glover had been arrested and was being imprisoned in Milwaukee.
I think the interesting piece is Sherman Booth riding through the town and going from small community to small community. Much like Paul Revere, Glover's here, Glover's here. We've got to break him out of jail.
So here he is in jail. There must have been people left in Racine who had helped him to attain his freedom who wouldn't have been particularly pleased with the situation.
No, Glover was fortunate that his other friend that he was playing cards with crawled out the window when the posse swept in And he went out and notified a newspaper editor, an abolitionist newspaper editor in Racine, who knew Glover, that Glover had been arrested. This editor put a post in the morning paper that would come out the following day saying that he had been arrested. The church bells were rung in the morning. The word spread very quickly. And
Okay, because we're going back to 1854. What did it mean at that time that church bells would have rung out?
So it usually indicate that something big, something noteworthy is happening and that people should gather. So with the church bells chiming, the article in the newspaper, which got out very early, and word of mouth, the largest crowd that had ever gathered in the town square in Racine at that point turned out. And
how many people? Any idea?
I think that I've read as many as 1,000 people, which, given the size of Racine at the time, would have probably been a pretty good percentage of the community. They were outraged that one of their neighbors had been abducted. And so they had a large protest rally, and then about 100 people were put together, assembled as sort of a reverse posse. And they got on a boat in Racine Harbor and went up to Milwaukee.
No, this is March.
This is March.
Is cold. There still had to
cold.
Be a little bit of ice on that lake.
It was wintry. Yeah, it was
so
very
why
cold.
Did they take a boat instead of
the roads back
wagons
then,
or
yeah, the roads back
cruises.
Then were horrible. Okay. They weren't paved. They were rutted, probably really worse in the winter. And to transport 100 people probably would have been a pretty significant task. So, you know, much easier to just go down to the port, jump on a boat, go up to Milwaukee and disembark and there you are. So,
okay, so
100
they got off the boat and where did they go?
The sheriff and 100 people went up there and their goal was to basically arrest the owner, Benamy Garland, and the U.S. Marshal for kidnapping and for assault. So,
and they had warrants.
Those were their intentions. Yeah, absolutely.
Did they have warrants for that?
I don't know. The sheriff was the one that made the decision that he was going to arrest them based
on
the sheriff of Racine.
Okay.
So it's kind of remarkable. It shows you the mindset of Wisconsinites that a local sheriff felt that he could arrest a U.S. marshal who was enforcing federal law because basically in the sheriff's mind, a free man had been abducted and beaten in a free state. So 100 people went up there to kind of turn things over. In the meantime, the newspaper editor in Racine had sent a telegram to a newspaper editor in Milwaukee, Sherman Booth was his name, and alerted him to the fact that Joshua Glover had been arrested. Sherman Booth goes over to the jail and tries to find out if this is true. They kind of try to sideline him. They won't answer his questions, but eventually he determines, yes, a fugitive slave is in the jail cell here. He gets out and he takes advantage of his newspaper printing presses and prints out a bunch of handbills to be spread across the state. And then when some of his friends and allies are doing that, I don't know. It must have been fairly quick because he would have gotten word Saturday morning on March 11th of 1854. And they basically were gearing people up to have a gathering at 2 p.m. So you must have been able to run them off fairly quickly. Then he gets on a horse and rides through the streets of Milwaukee. That it's just kind of a great picture, but riding through the downtown streets of Milwaukee like Paul Revere, calling people to turn out and telling them that a man's liberty is at stake and show up at the courthouse. So he rides, when he finishes that, you know, when he concludes his ride, he gets back, he heads to the courthouse, and by around 2 p.m., about 5,000 people had gathered in that square.
And that's on what day?
That was on March 11th, 1854.
So that's how many days after he had been kidnapped?
He had been kidnapped the night before, March 10th.
So within 24 hours, there was that kind of gathering
exactly.
of people.
Exactly, in Racine and Milwaukee.
Who are yeah. just outraged over what's happened.
Yeah.
How did the authorities react?
Well, they blew them off. The crowd basically kind of set up a formal, almost like a meeting-type atmosphere. They elected a president. They formed committees. They passed resolutions. They gave speeches. They filed for writs of habeas corpus, which is, you know, basically a legal due process step. And it was very orderly, but the officials, the court, the judges, the police, the marshals, they all just ignored their activities. So this went on for several hours, and it became clear, again, under the Fugitive Slave Act, officials not only could not release Joshua Glover, they were bound not to release him. So when that became clear to the crowd, a subsection of the mob decided to take things into their own hands. We're going to switch tactics here. And so they went over to the cathedral, which was being built at the time in Cathedral Square, and they grabbed a wooden beam from the construction site. They took it over to the courthouse, and they used it to batter down the courthouse door. And then they swooped inside. They overwhelmed the guards. They used some pickaxes to basically pull apart the jail cell door. They grab Joshua Glover and they bring him out into the larger crowd. And there's just massive rejoicing. One book describes it as though he were a conquering hero. People were cheering. They all wanted to shake his hand. There was great rejoicing. Then they put him on a carriage and swept him south to Walker's Point. And there they sent him on an even faster carriage. A gentleman down there volunteered. They put Joshua Glover on another carriage, and they whisked him away to Prairieville, which is today Waukesha, and began basically hiding him in the Underground Railroad over the course of many weeks.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
There was a massive manhunt looking far and wide for him, which is why they continued to move Joshua Glover from house to house.
Filmmaker Michael Jarre describes the manhunt for Joshua Glover.
You're listening to WTMJ Conversations.
I'm Libby Collins. Today's conversation is with Michael Jarre, the director-producer of Liberty at Stake, the Joshua Glover story.
In the weeks following his rescue, Glover was hidden in homes, attics, and barns along the Wisconsin Underground Railroad. He was eventually smuggled onto a ship in the Racine Harbor and taken to Canada, where he lived out the rest of his life in the freedom he so desperately sought.
Where did he end up from there?
So after about 3 or 4 weeks of probably being in at least 10 or so homes and barns and attics and who knows where, he ended up back, ironically, in Racine. There was a ship captain who had a reputation for smuggling fugitive slaves out of Wisconsin and into Canada. His name was A.P. Dutton, and he volunteered to take Joshua Glover out.
Okay. Benamy Garland, who had pursued Joshua Glover for 2 years, had him taken out of what he thought was his possession. Did he react at this point? I mean, did he try to pursue him? Was there an additional search for Glover at this point?
There was a massive manhunt. The feds were headed in all directions. And
federal authorities.
Yeah, and Garland was as well, particularly the U.S. Marshals. But yeah, basically law enforcement was looking far and wide for him, which is why they continued to move Joshua Glover from house to house, because, you know, it becomes a little risky. People begin to talk. Even children can be sometimes susceptible to saying, oh my gosh, there's somebody living in my attic. And then some other child tells their parents, and pretty soon the whole thing is blown. So they kept moving him, knowing that there was a pretty significant manhunt, and they managed to evade that and get him back to Racine on a ship, which took him through the Great Lakes and to Ontario, Canada. There he found his way to a small town just outside of Toronto, and there he lived the rest of his life in freedom.
Could runaway slaves be arrested in Canada at that time, or were they completely free?
They were completely free there. There was no longer any danger, unless, you know, I guess somebody could come up and actually kidnap them forcibly, but then they would have faced Canadian law, which would not have allowed that. So it would have been pretty risky. But for the most part, if a fugitive slave made it to Canada, they were free.
So what do we know about Joshua Glover once he really attained freedom?
So he found another family that was willing to kind of take him in there, provide him with some clothes initially, provide him with work. And he basically stayed in close contact with this family over the course of the rest of his life, which was about another 40 years. So he lived to be about 80 years old, best
and
as we can tell. He married twice, actually, while he was in Canada, both to Irish women, and both of them passed away after a fairly short time. I think one died of cholera and the other died of typhoid or something.
Did he have children?
Something like that. Not that we know of. We have not found any evidence that he ever had children. We would love to track down, you know, some of his descendants and actually talk to them, but we have not been able to find any evidence that he had children.
Do you know where he's buried?
Yes, he's actually buried in Toronto on the grounds of a hospital, basically, where he had, you know, they had taken his body. And then there's a park in Toronto. They have a much better memory of Joshua Glover in Toronto than we do here in Wisconsin. There's actually a park called Joshua Glover Park. And there's a bust, a statue of Joshua Glover at the center of that park, wearing a top hat, looking very sophisticated. But they actually commemorate his life there in Toronto in ways that we've kind of lost track of here in Wisconsin.
You've put together a mini documentary of this story. And by the way, Ken Harris, Dr. Ken Harris from our sister station, the Truth is one of the narrators of that. But the documentary that you've done, and again, it's brief, was shown at the Republican National Convention this past summer. And I remember there was a lot of buzz. There was something special going on, but nobody would tell us what it was, but we knew it was going to be at the Pabst Theater that night.
And that was your film. What was the reaction? Because your audience would have been Republican delegates. What was the reaction of the audience when you showed this film?
It was actually the fact that the RNC was coming to Milwaukee is what kind of triggered us to very quickly put together that 12-minute mini documentary. We thought, we've got 50,000 people coming to Milwaukee. They're going to be just blocks from where Joshua Glover is rescued. What, in terms of marketing, what better time to tell this story? So we did put it together. There was an RNC film festival that took place at the Miller Theater, and which is a beautiful historic place to show something like this. And since it's short, we actually had a chance to show it over the course of a day of six different times. And the response was fantastic. It was the same reaction that you've had, which is, I've never heard this story. Why have I never heard this story? This is a great story. And so the reaction was fantastic. And then we had a booth at the RNC as well with the Little White Schoolhouse, which also kind of comes into this story. But the Little White Schoolhouse up in Ripon shared a booth with us, and we got to tell, you know, hundreds and hundreds of delegates the story of Joshua Glover and the incidents that followed, including what took place in Ripon just 9 days later.
Because so many of those individuals who were protesting the arrest of Glover formed a whole new political party.
They did indeed. So Joshua Glover was rescued on March 11, 1854. On March 20th, just 9 days later, about 50 abolitionists met up in Ripon at the Little White Schoolhouse that was there. And they were Democrats, they were Whigs, they were Free Soil Party members. But they said, we need a new anti-slavery party in this country. And they came out of that gathering calling themselves Republicans, which became, obviously, the Party of Lincoln. So just a few years later, Lincoln would be elected, Southern secession would follow, Civil War, and eventually emancipation. So it was just one domino, one catalyst in a much bigger picture, but the impact was profound.
Coming up on WTMJ Conversations.
I've talked to different people in the industry who say, we get all kinds of stories pitched to us all the time. This one almost writes itself.
Filmmaker Michael Jarr talks about the hope that someday this story can be a feature film.
Now, more of WTMJ Conversations.
Welcome back. I'm Libby Collins. We're talking with filmmaker Michael Jarr about the mini documentary he's produced, Liberty at Stake, the Joshua Glover story. And of course, although you put together this very short documentary, you want to expand this into a longer form film. And by the way, you can see the 12-minute documentary, can't you?
Absolutely. If you go to our website, the name of the film is Liberty at Stake, the Joshua Glover story, at our website, which is www.lasfilm.com. LAS is in Liberty at Stake. You can watch the 12-minute video there that we showed at the RNC Film Festival, and you can learn more about the entire story. Our goal now is to create a 60 to 90-minute full-length documentary that tells the entirety of the story, and then hopefully have that on Netflix, on Prime, on PBS, and we want to have a curriculum that goes with it that could be taught in high schools and so on. So it's a very ambitious project.
Michael, what I have to ask you, because I was on the edge of my seat as you were telling me so much of the story, and there are all these little side things. This seems to me like this could be a feature film.
Absolutely. And that's what we're kind of thinking about in terms of next steps. Once we wrap up the documentary, our hope is to turn this into a feature film. I've talked to different people in the industry who say, we get all kinds of stories pitched to us all the time. This one almost writes itself. You can't do anything to make it stronger. It's got good and evil, David and Goliath. You've got unity and politics and history.
And maybe that little thing with the girlfriend that may have been with both of those individuals, too.
There are certainly some things that we can kind of enhance.
You've got to have that in there.
Absolutely.
Right. So the question I have for you, Michael Jarr, is, in a perfect world, who would play Joshua Glover on screen?
That is a great question. We would need somebody who would be in kind of their mid-30s. I don't know. Do you have any thoughts?
Oh, I've got a lot of thoughts, and I bet a lot of our listeners
maybe
out there
Dr.
do,
Ken.
Too. Yeah, I think he'd be a little too old, but I'm sure he'd like to be in the movie.
Yeah, and he is the narrator of our mini documentary and just did a fantastic job with that. I should add that, you know, even though this was shown at the RNC Film Festival, this is not a political film, it's a historical film. So actually, the mayor Mayor Cavalier Johnson actually appears in our mini-documentary, as do a variety of voices. So it really is more of a look at just the amazing things that took place in Racine, Milwaukee, and Wisconsin in 1854.
Well, again, it's a fascinating story. I'm so glad that you're sharing it with us, and I'm going to go right over to Cathedral Square and look for that plaque.
Absolutely. It's worth it, and it's kind of a shame that there's not more. There is also a mural at Fond du Lac, kind of the overpass there. There's a mural of Joshua Glover being rescued. But that's really all that we have in Milwaukee, and we probably really should have more.
We've been talking with filmmaker Michael Jarr about his documentary, Liberty at Stake, The Joshua Glover Story. Now, if you joined us late and you want to hear the entire conversation with Michael, go to WTMJ.com. And that's where you'll also find a partial transcript courtesy of eCourt Reporters. We also have a link that you can click to see that 12-minute mini-documentary. For WTMJ Conversations, I'm Libby Collins.